No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So please call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008. Maria, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Maria, how
yes,
are
sir.
You? We're having a few technical difficulties tonight. I'm getting our guests, but hopefully, I don't know, maybe Doug, you can keep on trying that number, see if we can get through. I guess we.
It sounds like it's a bad number, doesn't it, Doug?
Yeah, maybe it is. I don't know. I'm checking again. But anyway, in the meantime, let's talk. I hope we can get a hold of her because she's a fascinating guest, and we'd love to have her on. But how are you doing?
Well, let me tell you the sum total. In between research, writing, and publishing, if you will, I have made limoncello. I have baked a second loaf of banana bread. I have made rose water. I have made pectin. And I have cooked dishes that I haven't cooked in years, including tonight, beef stroganoff.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, I just got a message from the woman that's supposed to be on our show. So let me text her back. She says she's there at that number. Doug, maybe you could try her again, but I'll text her back and ask her to call in.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Please, you got to bear with me because I don't type so fast. Call.
No worries.
In and that number again is 888-627-6008.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe you should call in. And anyway, yeah, so we're all cooped up in the house and we're
how is that going?
Well, it's going okay, you know, except that you know, we're seeing here in Washington, I'm sure you've seen this as well in California, that we have people that are going out now. You know, I mean, they're tired of being inside.
Well, it was interesting on Friday when Gavin Newsom was giving his daily press conference, which is at 12 noon Pacific time. Mm-hmm. There were rallies going on, and one of the most egregious ones was in Orange County again, in Huntington Beach. There were thousands of people congregating, no masks, very few, and no 6 feet apart. And he had already taken them to task on Monday of this week because of their not spacing on the beaches. And so he closed down the beaches in Orange County only in the state of California. And all that did was further make them even more livid. And I was watching, they had a split screen as Governor Newsom is giving his conference, and you see these people swarming in Huntington Beach, and I was like, whoa, talk about uprising.
Yay, Molly's online too. Can we bring her in, Doug?
Hi.
Hi. Hey, we couldn't reach you. Thank God you're on top of things, and you reached us. Thanks so much for being on the show. We're so happy to have you. I've been following you on Twitter.
Oh, thanks.
And you're on Twitter a lot, and you have a lot to say. Yeah. And
a lot. So, one of my editors was like, sometimes I get in trouble because I'm tweeting when I should be finishing something.
Well, it's hard not to, isn't it? With things unfolding the way they are. And you know, I've read an article that that you did, maybe we can start here, about how the president needs to be on camera. What do you think that, I mean, I agree with you. And you know what? I even empathize with it a little bit, because as a politician, my wife will tell you, when I walk into a room, if I'm not walking around talking to everybody, I don't feel right. You know, she says a shark has got to swim and Michael's got to talk. So so I even empathize with that a little bit. But what does that mean for us, Molly?
I actually don't think those pressers should be televised. That, yeah. I didn't write that. That was Olivia Nuzzi, who thinks it. I think he shouldn't be televised, because I think that it's just too much misinformation getting out there, especially medical stuff during a pandemic. And he really is, you know, a lot of people don't believe him, but a percentage of the population believes really what he says, no matter what. And so I think it's actually, especially when it comes to, I mean, I don't think it necessarily matters if he says things that aren't true. I think it's all problematic, but it's really problematic when it comes to medical stuff, like that weird bleach comment, or his love of hydrochloric, whatever it's called.
Right, I know.
But I mean, you even see, like, so Gilead has this drug, remdesivir, which has like a 30% success rate. And so, look, it's not a cure-all by any stretch of the imagination, but if you're a patient who's really in dire straits, this is something that could possibly help you, right? 30%. And a lot of Trump supporters don't want it. They want the hydrocloxine, because Trump has been selling it to them. And so that kind of stuff, that's really scary. So that's why I think it's better not to televise that.
Well, and what do you think this environment is doing? You know, I saw an interview you did with your mom, Erica Jong, a feminist author, know, and you talked about her book that sold 35 million copies, which was released in 1973, right about the time the ERA was being passed, right about the time of Roe versus Wade. You know, so there was an environment there that I would argue made people receptive to the book. What do you think this environment is doing to women? What are we going to see after this? Do you have any sense as an author? Are we just going to have dystopian novels from now on? Or, you know, what's
going to happen? I think it's probably, you know, it's impossible to know what's going to happen. It tends to be, these moves tend to be cyclical. So right now we have a very conservative president who has really declared a war on choice. Now, as we've seen in the midterm, a lot of women got elected during the midterm. I actually interviewed Gretchen Whitmore for Tomorrow for Glamour, and I was asking her about, because when she was a lower level, she was the head of the State House in Michigan, and they did a lot of work on choice stuff. And, you know, this midterm had begot all these female politicians. So I do think the Democrats have this, like, very substantial bench of female politicians that they've never really had. So that, I think, is very exciting. And I would be very surprised, you know, with this kind of thing, with politics, I think really a lot of representation matters. So, and especially when it comes to women's issues like choice and you even saw it during the debates, like when they stopped having women on the podium, you stopped talking about women's issues. And women's issues are, you know, they're healthcare issues, they're human rights issues, they're everything. So I do think that we're going to see in this next cycle, we have two very white elderly men running against each other, but we also have a lot of women in the Senate and the House and the governorships. So I do think, I mean, we have a woman Democratic governor in Kansas, Michigan. True. And I mean, things are, this is, even though it's very dystopian, there's also a lot of really interesting stuff that has never happened.
Molly, this is Maria Sanchez. I'm Michael's co-host.
Hi, I'm sorry. I should interrupt.
It's okay. I just wanted to say that for our listeners who are just tuning in, ordinarily the senator gives an introduction. And would you mind doing that so that people know who we're
yeah.
talking with?
Hi.
Ordinarily, Michael, do you have something that you wanted to say?
Of course. If you don't know who Molly John Fast is, she's an editor at the Daily Beast. She's an author. She's a consummate Twitter person. She's on Twitter all the time. She's very opinionated, a feminist, raised by a feminist. Her mom was Erica Jong, of course, who wrote Fear of Flying and several other books as well.
A novelist and a wife and a mother
and a
of
wife
three.
And a mother. Yes.
Like I thought, and women I'm also able to have it all at once.
I'm also the granddaughter of a famous communist, Howard Fast.
Of Howard Fast, yes,
yeah. Right,
who went to jail but ran for Congress.
That's
always weird.
And so based on what we know of you now, if people didn't, Molly, what was it like growing up in your household? Your mother, Erica John, your father, Jonathan Fast, your grandfather, Howard Fast. What was your life like?
I mean, it was interesting and exciting, and we had a lot of smart people around, which was fun. And certain people I grew up with, I wish I had. Like, I never realized Gore Vidal was Gore Vidal until he was dead. Yeah. So certain people, like, I would have paid more attention to Gore Vidal. There were just different smart people around that were interesting. But it was also, I mean, my parents had a very fraught marriage. And, you know, it was one of those very sort of dysfunctional 1980s New York childhoods. But I do think it really helped me get, I don't know, I have a lot of appreciation for what I got to grow up with. And also I have been pretty interested in my children not having that childhood, but it was interesting and it definitely made me who I am. And I got to read a lot of books and meet a lot of smart people. And the other thing I think, which I see when one of my kids has started writing and has been publishing, and you don't believe you can do stuff like that unless you see other people doing it. And so that was very helpful for me, was I came from a house where everybody was just writing and it was never, I never felt like, oh, I can't do that. And I think so much of success in that literary world is just about believing you can do it.
You know, given that, I mean, I agree with you 100%, Molly. My sister, I had an older sister who graduated from law school at GW Law School, and she was one of like three or four women in her class in the early 1960s. And then she went back to preside over a graduation 30 years later, and 51% of the class was women. And I think that's so true. The more women that do things, the more women you're going to get doing. You know what I mean? I very much believe in what you say. But where do we stand with feminism right now? You know, we have the Equal Rights Amendment that just passed in Virginia. But here's a piece of legislation that was introduced by Alice Paul in 1923, revived in 1971. And we still haven't been able to get it enacted into law. What do you think that says about feminism these days?
The EPA is such a, I've written a bunch of pieces about it. It's such a, it's such an incredibly fraught thing, especially because it should have gotten passed a million years ago. I don't know. It passed in Virginia. It seems unlikely to me that Mitch McConnell is going to give women a win with this. I mean, it just seems impossible. But so much would happen. I think if Democrats could win the Senate, it could get passed. I'm not sure. It's such, in some ways, it's such a relic of another time, because it's so, I mean, I think most people just assume that there is an Equal Rights Act, which there's not. And so it's so sort of terrifying even to think about it. I don't know what's going to happen with it. I think if it goes up against Mitch McConnell's Senate, it won't, nothing will happen with it. But I think if it, if Democrats could win back the Senate in November, then probably it could pass. I wouldn't see why it wouldn't pass. I mean, it just
because there's
bare minimum.
Five states that did vote for it that have asked to revoke their ERA ratifications.
Right. And, well, and
so
also,
then that puts it below the number needed.
Right. Also, it's expired, too. I mean, there was, it expired in like 19-something, so, or 1983 or something. So the whole thing is kind of more wishful thinking than actual possible policy. And I'm not sure so much of the bill itself is really dated, so I don't know what would happen. It doesn't, it's not, I don't think many women are hanging their hats on it. But sure, I mean, look, if it got passed, it would be amazing. It's such a, the fact that it didn't get passed is such a sort of like a legacy of that one woman can really derail the whole thing with Phyllis Schlafly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is amazing that she was able to do that.
No,
yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I want to say what I found is interesting, because Michael and I are similar generation, you're a younger generation, and then I have a niece, for example, who's in her mid-30s. She is completely and totally against feminism. And I look at her and I'm like, what? Where did, what? How can that possibly be? You don't know what happened before you came around, and the glass ceiling and, you know, the cents on the dollars that we didn't get and still don't and all that. So I'm shocked that the younger generation, and I don't know if it's because we haven't done a good job about bringing them along with what it once was and what still needs to be done. Do you have an opinion on that, Molly, since you have children?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be some, there's always going to be some people who are anti-feminist, however strange that may be or whatever that means. Look, we have a big conservative movement we have a big conservative movement that's sort of pro-Trump for whatever reason and doesn't have problems with a lot of Trump's weird sexual assault allegations and all of his problems with women. And, you know, the fact that his cabinet has one woman in it, and that when they try to advertise themselves as so pro women, they can only point to the wives and daughters. So I don't know. I mean, there are certainly people who don't think feminism is important, but I think some of that is because people have shifted the word feminism and into what, like, feminism just means believing in equal rights for women. So
right.
I'm not sure why one would have a problem with that as a woman.
That's what I don't get either. And I think it could be because of Limbaugh doing the feminazi thing and making people think that if you're a feminist, that means you're a radical. Instead of, we just want, we want some same parity.
Well, and you know what, Molly, you have a podcast called The New Abnormal, and this is really something that I wonder about. Now we've just lost, 30 million plus jobs. Women are certainly at the lower end of the labor pool in America, and like the Second World War pulled women out of the kitchen and put them in the factories. Is the coronavirus, you think, going to pull them out of the factories and push them back in the kitchen? Because we're going to lose so many of these manufacturing jobs and you know, support jobs.
I think that we don't know what any of this is going to look like. We really don't. We really don't know what it's going to look like. I'm like loath to even get involved in this conversation, because I don't think there's enough information, honestly. Like the economy has never stopped. and restarted. So I think that we have a lot of problems. I don't know. Again, there's so many variables. We don't know, like, if there's a really successful treatment, if there's a vaccine, if we can control it. So I don't know. I mean, it's possible that we will have, like, a mind-crushing recession of which we have never seen the likes of. Certainly possible. I know that the financial hemorrhaging is going to continue until we have some kind of mitigation or vaccine, which of which we have neither right now. So I don't know. It really could go either way. It's just I think it's an unprecedented and also totally terrifying time.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely in ground zero, aren't you, Molly?
Yeah, I'm in New York.
Yeah. What is life like that for you guys?
You know,
because at least Michael and I are in the suburbs.
Yeah, we are very affected by it. I know a lot of people who've had it. A lot. Most of the people I know who've had it have been fine. I have known some people who have died. It's really scary. I mean, it's really, really, really contagious. I don't think that I think it's more, you get it person to person. I think there's clearly some kind of aerosol element to it. It's really scary. I mean, we've been in our house for like almost 2 months, and I mean, the thing that I think is the scariest is there's no plan to get us out of it. There's no test. You know, we have these antibody tests, and everyone in New York is getting antibody tests, but there's like a 30% false negative. And then there's so many variables. It's really scary. So I don't know how this is going to play out. It's really scary. And unknown.
And I've noticed that you're tweeting out a lot, Molly, about the opening up of America. You know, we just saw, for example, in D.C., there was a flyover yesterday with the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds, nice. Which I thought was so, you know, it was great, but irresponsible. It just pulled thousands of people out onto the mall, you know, to watch this happen. And you know, we've just seen Wharton Business School, University of Pennsylvania, Wharton has a group that's just come out that said that they think that if we start reopening states now, there could be 233,000 additional deaths, 350,000 by the end of June. I mean, it just seems crazy to me. And I'm a guy that grew up living paycheck to paycheck, so I understand the angst that people have. But what is legislators should we be doing, especially since you just talked to the governor of Michigan, who's come under so much fire for this?
Well, I mean, the problem is even if you reopen, which I think people aren't talking about enough, consumers are not excited. They don't trust the government. And I think fundamentally, one of the problems of Trumpism that you're going to see more and more is, so some of Trump's supporters will believe anything he says. But even those people, when they start, maybe they haven't seen what I've seen, but where I live, one in every 1,000 New Yorkers has died. Okay? So we all know, I mean, I know a few people whose fathers have died. I know one person in his 50s who's died. Like, I know there are a lot of people who have died here. So I don't know how you trust. I never trusted Trump. But say you're a Trump supporter and you've trusted him for so long and he's been shopping you this idea that it's the flu, or maybe then he changed his tune. I mean, even you go to Fox News and they're very inconsistent about what they're saying about it. And then you have people in your family die. I'm not entirely sure what happened. I'm not sure how those people can trust him to go out to dinner.
We're certainly seeing that here too. My neighbor died My friend right. of my mother's, a friend's mother died. Now these were people in their 90s, but right. Yeah, we're seeing more and more of that. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
The thing about it is, most of the people who die are over the age of 70, but some of the people who die are 30 and 40, yeah. and you know, there is, and so. You can't, you know, it's Russian roulette. Like, probably, right? The survival rate is, you know, 98% maybe. But, so you have a good shot of living, but you also have chance that, you know, there's all sorts of insane side effects. They don't really know how to treat it. I mean, it's just such, you're just taking such a gamble. And I think ultimately, a lot of smart people aren't willing to take that gamble.
Yeah.
And so that's why this whole idea of opening up is so nuts.
Unless we let water find its own level and practice social distancing and wear the face masks, and the restaurants are at 50% capacity and they take the temperatures of everybody coming in, which I know means asymptomatic people will get in. Or people don't, and then you tried, but it didn't work. I mean, our auto mall just opened up this week, and it's mostly for maintenance things. Right. And if you want to purchase a car, you have to make an appointment, and you can't just show up. And the same is true with pet adoptions and things like that. They're starting to ease a little bit, but there's no casual drop-in, walk-in kind of thing. You've got to make an appointment. And so you can control those environments. They're even talking about opening up Hollywood and having their productions on set so that you're not on location where who knows what is going on. You sanitize the building, the equipment, the people, et cetera, et cetera. And they're making those talks. That may happen this month. They're saying some intimate scenes between two actors might have to be filmed separately, and then they're going to stitch it together somehow.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a way around, if we're smart, there's a way around a lot of this, right? Even like today,
yes.
I went to Starbucks and we all waited out, you know, we waited outside, and then they had, you know, we were all wearing gloves and masks and staying away from each other. But I do think if people are smart, there's a way to do this.
I do too.
But it's going to be it's a question of people being careful. I do think, even though New York has this insane, it's so interesting because so much has gone wrong here. Like, if you look at California, you realize how much has gone wrong in New York. Because San Francisco had it before us, and they've completely shut it down.
Yep.
So
the first case was in early February, like February 6th.
Right. And they have public transport, and they are very crowded, and they have everything we have, and they just were able to shut it down. And I actually think there were 5 days when Cuomo and de Blasio bickered about whether or not to close the schools, and those 5 days may have cost thousands of lives. You know,
probably.
We're going to look back on this time as just an incredible, as just a series of, like, just incompetence after incompetence.
Yeah, and I've got to tell you, I read in one of your tweets, Molly, I couldn't believe you could not make this stuff up, that the new chief of staff, a guy named Mark Meadows, who we love in Washington because he stood against every piece of progressive legislation that we've ever brought up to the Hill. I mean, you know, our only solace here is that he's no longer in Congress and can't fight us up there. But he said his biggest concern as the new chief of staff is making sure the president gets time to get a quick bite. Is that, I mean, is it just me or is... Are people fiddling as Rome's burning? I mean, I think this is something your mother should be telling you. Make sure you eat.
I mean, I think that was a fascinating story, because there's no way that Trump is going to be happy with that story.
No.
And I think Meadows thought that he was endearing himself to Trump with that. But, you know, Trump doesn't want people talking about whether he can eat. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, really, you know, it doesn't seem like leadership to me. I think that leaders should be out there saying to people, buy stuff on the internet from local businesses. You know, do what you can to help people. Hey, I'd like to change the subject. And I got to tell you, I do this with great trepidation because I've had several women in my own family attack me for this. But I want to talk about Tara Reid for a second.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up.
In the face of feminism. Now, I saw Mika Brzezinski. I'm a superdelegate, and I'm a Joe Biden delegate. And I saw Mika Brzezinski just attack the vice president the other day and ask him to prove pretty much that he hadn't sexually assaulted Tara Reid. And I don't know how you do that. Is this like the new kryptonite that I think that, as the vice president said, she should be believed and her allegations should be fully investigated. But really, have we shifted so now politicians have to prove their innocence rather than
I would say this. I just wrote a piece about this actually for tomorrow in The Beast. I think the problem with all of this is that people no longer, like, conservatives are so excited about this allegation, and they're convinced that they're going to be able to use this.
When I try to talk to women about this, I immediately get the vibe that I'm a guy, shut up, I don't know. You know what I mean? It's such a hot button because women have put up with this kind of behavior for so many years, so many years. So what do we do? Is there something we can do to combat it? I mean, right? Yeah, go ahead.
So I would say this. The most important thing with all of these allegations is that they're looked at as, I mean, I was reading all the stuff in the conservative media this weekend about it, and they're just thrilled. And they want to get back at Democrats they want to get back at Democrats for Kavanaugh by using... Right. And the thing is, this is not, I think Me Too is not about using, it's not a cudgel. Like, it's not something we, you know, you use when it politically suits you. And I think that it's really important that as Me Too, we sort of think of the victims and not of, and the alleged victims, right? We don't know what happened, and we're never going to probably know what happened. But it's important that these things are looked at really through the lens of, you know, completely removed from partisanship. And also, I think very much that we need to, like, it can't be, this cannot be used as a football. So I don't know, you know, none of us really know, but it is definitely the way it's being handled is really, I don't know, it's a lot of questions, and I don't know. I mean, it's really problematic.
Yeah, I see that too. You know,
and the fact that there's corroboration coming from others who remember having the conversation with her in 95 or 96, it just makes it all so dirty.
It's impossible. I mean, the thing is, it's impossible. I would say, the one thing I would say is I think he answered it well. You know, he said it should be investigated. He did, like, if you look at Trump, who has said things like, I never knew the person, and then he knew them, or he said they weren't my type or they weren't attractive enough. Biden didn't do any of that, which was good. He really was very firm in his, and he did as well as he could in that impossible situation. So I don't know how this plays out. I don't know where we go from here. But I do know that it's really unfair for the media to ask women to sort of weigh in on it, especially like potential VP candidates to go to someone or AOC to make these women choose is impossible and really unfair. So that, I think asking them about it is incredibly unfair because they don't know. And they have a responsibility, or at least they feel they have a responsibility. And because Democrats aren't as partisan in the same way as Republicans, you know, if you asked an Alyssa, if you asked a female senator, like, I'm trying to think of, you know, not maybe not Susan Collins, but if you asked a female senator if they believe Trump's allegations, you know, a lot of them would not hesitate to defend Trump and attack the woman. And so, but Democrats aren't as partisan in a certain way. So you're asking these women to really, I mean, you see it with Gillibrand. That's the thing I think is really unfair. Is like, and I saw a lot of this weekend where I was reading all this conservative media, is they're going after Gillibrand for supporting Biden when it's really not, that's not really how, it's not really fair.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, Maria, I got to point this out. She has come up with five people to collaborate this, but three said that she never said anything to them about it. One's not sure, and only one of the five people says, yeah, they remember that she said something about it. So there's a lot of evidence out there. You've got Lindsey Graham standing up for the guy, for right. God's sakes. You know, there's a lot of evidence out there that you can do it. But then again, you know, as a guy, I understand there's very little you can say about it. You know, my two daughters attacked me about it, you know, which is another thing that I find funny about feminism is I just read an ad the other day from the 1950s that said it was for cold cream or something. And it said, guys ask, is she pretty? They don't ask, is she clever? Now, my daughters would both freak out if they saw that ad. They would just, you know, but then again, I call my daughter a few weeks ago, and she and all her college-educated buddies were sitting around, all women, with a glass of wine, watching
The Bachelor. How did I know the answer to that?
Yeah, it's like, are they really watching a bunch of women fighting over one guy? What does that mean?
My daughter does it religiously.
Yeah,
and I'm like, how can you participate in this? This is terrible. It's just like my niece, who I mentioned before. She was a huge fan of that three-part series about the S, whatever do you call it, bondage and whatever the was so popular with everybody.
I don't remember
the novel. Oh, do you know Hollywood? Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And I was like, how can you be a woman in business and think that that's entertaining? That's terrible. And even my mother was reading the trilogy, and I was like, Mom, what are you doing?
Well, poor Ned, Universal Appeal. But you have a daughter, right, Molly? How old?
Yeah, she's 12.
12. So she's just getting into the
hormones.
It's
a wild ride.
And the good news is, just hang in there because they get better.
Yes, know? They it's do.
Like, yeah.
I remember with my two daughters, 13 to 15, all I could think is, what were we thinking? Why didn't we just, you know, why didn't we just get another dog? Why do we have to have kids? But it gets a lot better. But I think it's a real challenge for people like you, for mothers like you, in this environment to be bringing girls up. I don't know what you say to them. I know that I said to my daughters, I said some things that were sexist about, you know, be careful. I said things to them I wouldn't have said to my son. I don't know how those things are changing, though. It's a very, very, very tough time to bring up kids. I also like to say, and what do you think about this? I think the bigger problem than President Trump is the 40% of America that stands behind President Trump. Because they're not going anywhere. No matter who we elect, they're still going to be out there. Any insight on how we shorten the divide between the two of us? Yeah. shift the narrative so that we're not so far apart in this country?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think we'll see what this whole financial meltdown looks like, and if it's like the Great Depression, or if it's like, you know, we don't know what it, that could be like 2008. It could be, look, definitely having a president who ran on a racist lie, birtherism, did not help us get more connected. And he's really, really sowed a lot of division and been really committed to doing that. I don't know what's going to happen now. I hope that people get more connected. But, you know, this move to automation, the death of a lot of these very good jobs, yeah. You know, the coal mining, the oil, the landscape has changed a lot. And we don't know quite what, there's a lot of anger from a lot of people who feel their way of life is gone.
Yeah, and I think it's ironic that Walmart and Amazon may be making as much money now as they ever did. You know, these people that are taking over our lives, they're not the people that are hurting, really, right? We're still buying groceries. We're still, my wife got something delivered today from Amazon. So they're still active. And yeah, and I think you're very, very right that the way forward at this point is very, very unclear. Maria, what do you want to add?
I just would like to know, Molly, who are your inspirations? Who keep you coming to your computer and to your Twitter account? What helps you keep the cause going when there seems sometimes that we've lost our way as a country?
Well, there are a lot of really smart women in media, a lot of really smart women in politics. In some ways, that's the thing, is as much as I feel despairing about a lot of things that have happened during the Trump administration, there are so many good writers writing stuff right now, and so many interesting female politicians, and male too, but like there's a group, I mean, from Jaipal, Representative Jaipal, to AOC, it's a very, you know, Governor Whitmer. It's an exciting time for women in politics. Tammy Duckworth. There are a lot of exciting women in the Senate, and in the governorship. So in some ways, in Gina Raimondo, I'm very excited to see what these women do. And a lot of them are young for politics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I would say that, and then I also think, you know, there are just a lot of very good writers. There's a lot of interesting stuff. I get inspired by if things are just really insane, or the opposite, which is just sort of really inspiring, and so both. But this has been really insane, and the thing that's so insane about it is, we saw it coming. Like, if the government had just got its stuff together, they would have been able, like, it's like SARS. It never had to come here. This never had to happen. Like, if you look at South Korea, we really got here through endless incompetence at every stage. And so that is kind of, that is both inspirational in its incredible stupidity, and also, a little bit interesting.
Well, you know, that brings me to another one of your tweets the other day about how crazy it would be if North Korea had a woman leader before the United States,
gosh.
Which I agree with you. You know, look, I don't get it because, you know, you've got India, Israel, England, Germany, France, the Philippines, Canada. You could go on, literally, you could go on for the entire hour of the show just talking about countries that have been led by women. So since you think there's a lot of great women out there, who do you think should be Biden's running mate? Do you have a choice?
Oh, I have. There's so many good choices. My dream is Tammy Duckworth. I love her. I would be thrilled with Gretchen Whitmer. I would be thrilled with, I love Kamala Harris. I mean, I think she's really great. I think she'd be amazing vice president. She's really tough, really smart. There are so many good candidates. He really can't. I don't think. I mean, I love Val Demings from Florida, and she's incredible. She's just an incredible politician and so smart, and also a really gifted orator. So he can't go wrong if he picks a woman. I think. I mean, he could pick a man too, but I think that when Hillary picked Tim Kaine, it was such a disappointment for so many of us because he just was such an unexciting candidate. And also the other thing, and I think that we talked about this before, representation matters. Like if you don't, you have, the Democratic Party owes such a debt to African-American women who have like really delivered from that for them endlessly and continuously. And for that, for us not to have an African-American woman on the ticket, I think is really kind of nuts, especially when we have so many really gifted African-American female politicians. So I don't know what he's going to do. It's a very tough decision, and a lot of people are going to be mad either way. But I do think the Democratic Party has really, like, the heart and soul of this party has been these African-American women. So I do hope that they will, that they'll think about that.
Well, you know, Tim Kaine's a really good example. Really nice guy, really great guy. But you're right, not the least bit exciting. And that's one of the problems with this job, right, is they always want, I think that rules Kamala Harris out. For them, is that you don't want somebody that's going to be more exciting than the candidate, and in this case, you know, I think I think Biden's the right choice, but I think he's comfort food. I don't think that you know that you have
good with her though.
Yeah, he did, and you know, but then again, Maria, you think California will go Democratic?
Oh. We're not only not purple, we're as blue can be.
Yeah.
But, Molly, just with a little time left, I loved your article about Melania Trump being AWOL as first lady. Do you want to mention a little bit about that? That you published that last month.
Yeah, I was interested. I mean, it's so funny because this administration is so dysfunctional that we forget what normal looks like. So we forget like what a normal first lady would do. And I was looking back at all these first ladies and like even Pat Nixon like went to a leper colony. Like so many of these first ladies have done these extremely good jobs. And it's not like from a feminist point of view, this is not a great job, right? You sort of try desperately to do something, but you're kind of put off to the side. But they've still, I mean, the Bush wives did all sorts of literacy stuff. And Nancy Reagan did drugs. So I do think that they just could not get her together to do anything. And she ended up doing nothing. You know, we have these lines at these food banks. She could have been making masks, you know, sewing masks with children. She could have been donating blood. She could have been, there were just a million good photo ops for her and she chose none of them. And what I think is interesting, again, and it just comes back to this single trope in this administration is are they incompetent or are they really just evil? Like, it's like a dumb win. Like, it would be easy to do this, and they couldn't do it. And it's like when Pence went to the Mayo Clinic, like, this is not rocket science, you know, and he wouldn't wear a mask. And so the whole visit was about him not wearing the mask. And did the Mayo Clinic delete the tweet? And this would have been, these are easy wins for a normal administration. Like, sending your vice president to the Mayo Clinic should not be an enormous controversy.
And he was advised prior to going in that that was protocol, because I was like, who didn't get to him? But they did. And then they still let him in, which was.
And then they wanted to target the journalist who tweeted about it. I mean, the whole thing is like, this is just so dumb, and none of it needed to happen. And
I just want to remind you about what you mentioned, Molly, pardon my interruption, that First Lady Barbara Bush, I think it was in the late 80s, was hugging a baby that had HIV/AIDS. And she wasn't enshrouded in any PPE or what have you, to your point that that is what could be done and has been done and isn't being done.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, guys. And thank you so much, Molly, for being on the show. You have a new devoted Twitter follower, for what that's worth.
And your handle is?
Tell people how to find your podcast real quick.
My podcast is on Spotify and on it's on Apple and Spotify and all of those other podcast places. And my pieces are at the Daily Beast and also at Vogue and a couple of other places. But, and my Twitter is Molly Jong Fast, all one word.
Which is perfect.
Well, and you know what? Yeah. We're going to have you back at some point because there's so much to talk about. But thank you so much for being on our show. And ladies and gentlemen,
thank you for your time, Molly.
Yeah, thank you for your time. And thank you for tuning in. And, you know, we always leave you with the song. So this is a corny song, but it's still holds true, I think. It came out about the time Molly's mom published her book. This is a classic from Helen Reddy, I Am Woman. And we'll see you next week. And thanks again, Molly.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. Give the people their right to vote.